This free program is paid for by the listeners of WBAI New York. If you're not already a member, think about joining us to help keep free speech alive.
On this edition of Nonfiction, the electric vibrator is, to say the least, a device with a complicated past. Today, we'll discuss a film that attempts to untangle the history of the device while giving a more balanced look at women's health and sexual pleasure. But first, in the fan film scene, amateur movie makers recreate their own versions of Hollywood blockbusters, often giving their versions new twists. We'll talk with the author of a book on the fan film phenomenon, all on this edition of Nonfiction. An eventful end there for Steve Coleman and the Metrics from their 1995 album, The Way of the Cypher, and that track is called Hyped. And I think what happened, Michael G., is that sometimes the older CDs, they just deteriorate. And I think they said that these things would last hundreds of years, but they were off by about 90. So anyway, yes, thanks to Steve Coleman and Metrics, The Way of the Cypher, 1995, and that track is called Hyped. I gotta get another version of it. I gotta get another copy of this CD because it's a great CD, but I don't know. CD technology is shaky sometimes. Oh, anyway, my name's Harry Allen, and this is Nonfiction, a magazine of the arts, ideas, and fact. And it's about nearly 5 minutes after 2 today on the 20th of March, 2009. And always glad to be your host here for the 2 o'clock hour on Fridays, as we've been doing for a number of years now. And looking forward, as always, to today's conversations. To begin, we're going to be speaking with the author of a new book on the fan film phenomenon. Our guest, Clive Young, has authored a book on Continuum Press, Homemade Hollywood, Fans Behind the Camera. And it discusses the history of people making movies based on pre-existing properties, but doing so in a low-budget way on their own dime with amateur actors and effects and their own cameras, usually out of some form of homage. Some of you may even remember a few years ago news getting out, and in fact, a film being made about the makers, the teenage makers of a film that recreated shot for shot Raiders of the Lost Ark, a Steven Spielberg film from the early 80s. A group of young men who were huge fans of the film while they were still teens did their own version of the film, remaking it shot for shot on their allowances. And Spielberg found out about the film many years later and considered it, if you will, a great tribute. And a film was made about their making of this film. And this kind of, if you will, encapsulates, not the documentary that followed, of course, but the idea of amateurs making their own movies of movies. It kind of encapsulates this whole idea of the fan film phenomenon. And there have been people doing this for years, decades, but there's been an increase, if you will, in this phenomenon in the last few years. So we'll talk to Clive Young about that. And then in the second half of our program, we'll be speaking with producer-director Wendy Slick. Her film is titled Passion and Power, The Technology of Orgasm. And it's a history of the vibrator, the electric vibrator, the sexual device, the sexual aid, and its history, its development, and its roots in the treatment of women's health. But as all things having to do with women's health, there is a complicated and sometimes twisted history to the development of this device. And the filmmakers have used the story of the vibrator as a way of talking about women's health and women's sexuality. And so we'll be talking with Wendy Slick in the second half of our program. But first, let's welcome Clive Young to our show. Clive Young is an author and lecturer covering the crossroads between high-tech and popular culture. He's the senior editor for ProSense. He's our guest today on Nonfiction and the WBAI. Clive Young, welcome to Nonfiction and to WBAI.
Well, thanks a lot for having me here.
What is this book about?
Well, like you were saying, it's certainly about folks making their own sort of homages to favorite franchises, be it TV or film or this or that. It's also a little bit about the intellectual property issues that goes behind that, because, I mean, they are breaking the law by making these movies, even if they mean them as a tribute. And in a way, that kind of makes them sort of, I mean, you hear a lot about outlaw cinema. Well, that's actually what these people are doing. I mean, folks like Quentin Tarantino can certainly paint themselves in that fashion. But when you're breaking the law to make your homemade Iron Man movie or whatever you're wanting to pay tribute to, I mean, that's actually a different case. There have been a couple of cases where the people who own these properties, the studios and comic book companies and TV folks, have come after the people who made these movies, ironically. And there are other cases where they think that, you know, it, like you were saying with Spielberg, that it's a great tribute. So the reaction to them is all over the map.
Why did you write this book?
You know, it's such a fascinating subculture. I mean, so a lot of it had to do, frankly, with the stories behind it. I mean, like you mentioned, the three kids who in Mississippi who made the Raiders of the Lost Ark movie. I mean, that's a perfect example. They spent 7 years from when they were 11 to when they were 18. I mean, sure, everybody, you know, when they're a kid, they play act and stuff. And you think, wow, wouldn't it be great to make our own movie? And nobody told them that, you know, this is impossible. You can't do it. They dragged themselves underneath a truck. They built a boulder that they could be chased by. And this
is recreating the scenes from the film.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. They did absolutely everything. They set themselves on fire. I mean, now they're, you know, they're my age. They're almost 40, and they look back on it and say, thank God, nobody got killed. How did we somehow avoid that? But, I mean, they
have the benefit or curse of having documented the foolishness of youth.
Oh yes. When their parents found out what they had done, setting their whole basement on fire and themselves, their production got shut down for a year. So.
Wow.
Yeah. And so, I mean, people are very dedicated to these things. I mean, you'd think of it as like, oh, well, this is an interesting thing to do for an afternoon, but for some folks, it really becomes an obsession, which is sometimes a cool thing, sometimes not so cool.
What is a fan film?
A fan film... It's kind of all over the map, but generally it's considered to be a tribute movie made for nonprofit. Basically, being that you're using copyrighted characters, it's not like you can charge people to see your movie or to buy a DVD from you on the internet or something like that. And it's basically, more often than not, it's done as a tribute. Sometimes it's done as a political statement. I mean, there's been a couple of Star Wars fan films where people take issue with George Lucas and the way they feel that he's mistreated his fans and things. It's all over the map. I mean, but by and large, the vast, vast majority of them are done kind of as a way of saying, this is something I like, and here's my idea for a new way to look at it.
So people will be fans, typically, of characters or stories or settings, movie, if you will, movie characters or movie characters from films, and they'll say, I could make my own James Bond movie, or I could make my own, you said Iron Man, or I could make my own Spider-Man film. And will then get their friends together or hire, I guess, people through the newspapers or whatever and put, you know, together a cast and shoot it themselves and do this just for the fun of doing it, not because they're going to be able to sell tickets or sell DVDs, but just as a way of achieving this.
It certainly is a labor of love. I mean, a lot of people, they do it just so, you know, let's say they want to dress up and see what they would look like as Batman, you know, beating up a bad guy. Some people do it as a way of trying to get attention for their film career. I mean, there's been a number of people who spent anywhere up to $100,000 on their homemade Star Trek movies. I mean, there's a guy up in the top of New York State who spent $100,000 on his bridge set for a Star Trek movie, and he's had George Takei from The Real Show on there and a couple of who played Sulu, and he had Chekhov from The Real Show, and he's had writers and directors from the original show all working on his little episodes, and he's trying to make the... You know, there was supposed to be a five-year mission, you remember, so the show only lasted 3 years, so he's trying to make those missing two seasons. And, you know, I mean, I could personally think of a lot of better things to do with $100,000, but this is something that he really sincerely loves and believes in, and it has done a heck of a lot for that franchise, quite frankly. I mean, the folks at Paramount love what he's done.
So, really?
Yeah.
And you mentioned before, and I should say, we hadn't spoken about this, but I had the opportunity and the pleasure of writing about the fan film phenomenon in 2001 for Premiere magazine.
Oh,
they were still publishing at the time. And I particularly focused on Star Wars fan films, even though we looked at, you know, other kinds of films just briefly. And one thing you've done in your book is you've talked about the history of these films. As you say in your book, a lot of people, when looking at the fan film phenomenon, think that it goes back to Hardware Wars, the Star Wars spoof, but you show that it goes back, in fact, decades before that. But more in your book, you talk about passion, and that's a word that I always say we believe in here at Nonfiction, in the value of passion. What role does passion play in the fan film phenomenon?
Well, you know, I mean, the fact that people would pour so much time and so much effort into creating something which at most you can get emotional value out of. I mean, you can't get the financial aspect out. I mean, a lot of folks, particularly in the economy the way it is, I mean, if they have free time, God forbid, you know, a lot of folks are looking for ways to actually put that to use for them. These are folks who are saying, you know, not only am I not going to make money on this, I'm going to pour a whole lot of money into it. You know,
and time.
And absolutely.
And credibility in relationships.
Sure. Yeah. Absolutely. I mean, there's any number of folks who, when I interviewed them, you know, it's like, all right, well, by the way, what did your wife think of this? What did your family think of this? And everybody kind of sidesteps the issue.
Yeah, no one ever says, oh, they were gung-ho. They really believe that if I spent $100,000 recreating the bridge of a canceled 60s science fiction show, that it would put us in a better footing.
And yet, you know, in some cases there are. I mean, there is a couple who I write about in there who made a movie called Star Wars Revelations, which is a 40-minute Star Wars movie. The wife wrote it. The guy directed it. They spent $20,000 on it. They took out a second mortgage. They had three kids during the 3 years that they were building, making this thing. And it kind of went from this is our hobby to three kids later. It's okay. Well, you know, we've put so much into this that we really have to knock this one out of the park so we can, in theory, hopefully get like some kind of directing gig out of it. Otherwise, we're really up the creek. And as it turns out, it did work out for them. They wound up writing and directing a web series, which isn't out yet, which was picked up by Disney.
Amazing, amazing.
Yeah.
We're speaking with Clive Young. He's the author of the new book, Homemade Hollywood, Fans Behind the Camera. It's on Continuum Press, and it documents the fan film phenomenon, which is a scene. I guess you could say it's a scene. It's certainly a lot of disconnected individuals for the most part, but also connected to the fans of given TV or film properties, whether it's James Bond or Star Trek or Star Wars or The Hulk or Iron Man or Batman, people who make their own films out of passion. And those of you who listen to nonfiction know that I often say that the only work you should ever do is the work that you would jump out of bed every day and do for free. When speaking about labor, the job one has. And there are lots of people who make films, but there are probably a lot fewer people who make films who say, if I wasn't getting paid to do this, I would jump out of bed every day and do it for free. Well, the people who make fan films do it for free. I don't know if they jump out of bed, but they certainly do the work. And so there's a lot certainly to be said about this phenomenon and why it's occurring. Now, we know movie making as a technology has existed for over 100 years. It's only in the last decade, however, that the creation of high-quality, low-cost digital cameras, as well as inexpensive computer-based editing editing and effects software, have created this explosion in the making of fan films. And to that, we would also add, of course, the wide acceptance and connectivity of the internet,
sure,
which aided people seeing these films and getting in contact with other people. And it's just really collapsed really a lot of what was at one point very disparate, people working on their own. You call it a revolution. Who were some of the leaders of this revolution in fan films?
Well, you know what? It really depends on how you look at it. Because, I mean, for instance, it's very easy to point to the most popular films, which tend to be the ones that mimic Hollywood the most closely. I mean, there's a fellow by the name of Sandy Calora, who, New Yorker, who moved to L.A. He made a $30,000 Batman movie. It's 10 minutes long, where Batman fights Joker and then the Predator from the Predator movies and then the Alien from the Alien movies. And I mean, if you're looking for a plot, you can go elsewhere. But if you want to just see some old-fashioned rock'em sock'em, I mean, it's a very well-made movie. A lot of people point to him. However, I mean, personally, I find a lot of the spirit of fan films is found in the low-budget things. I mean, things where people are just looking to explore an idea or find a new way to express something. I mean, for instance, there's a movie which I mention only very briefly in the book called A Message from Batman, which is just this guy with a beard, jowly beard, and his beer gut, and he has on a Batman mask, and he's just standing in front of a wall. I mean, this cost him about $1.98 to make this movie. And he's theoretically Batman doing a PSA, just doing a public service announcement, telling kids to make the right decisions. And in the process of about 2 minutes of just sort of just monologuing, he basically points out just how absolutely ludicrous the idea of Batman is if in a quote-unquote real world. And yet it's very funny, but it makes a very sweet point. And it's a very interesting thing. And like I said, it costs absolutely nothing. I mean, you can spend $100,000 if you like. And spend $1.98 if you like. What you need, of course, is an idea and something to say.
Interesting. One of the fan films that I became very enamored of, well, one that you also speak very highly of, is the film Titanic, which was, and it's spelled T-I-E-Tanic, and it's a play, it's a pun, it's a play on the word Titanic, the film by James Cameron, and of course the famed ocean liner that sank in 1912. But what this filmmaker did was reimagine the destruction of the Titanic as being completed by an onslaught of TIE fighters from Star Wars.
Right.
And so he's merged these two kind of – and I wrote about this piece in this film in my article for Premiere, but never was able to find out who the filmmaker was. I was never able to get in contact with them. I don't know if you ever did.
I wasn't able to. I found somebody who the name of somebody who works
and part of the reason
industry.
This is significant is because this is one of the most brilliant things I'd ever seen.
Oh, I concur. It is awesome.
It's so humorous, and there's so many details in it. It's a very short thing. But it's packed with details and in-jokes that are just, like, amazing. You just never find the guy who did it. You say you came close.
Yeah, I found the person who I'm pretty sure, I mean, same last name. The guy's name is John Bunt. And as the person who I found is a CGI animator in Hollywood. Dropped him a couple of emails, no response. And you know, being that the film is so aggressive towards Lucasfilm, and now that's how theoretically, if this is the same
and violates
person,
two huge copyrights, right?
Yeah, and two very big employers of computer graphic artists.
Yeah, there you go.
It might be well to keep a low profile.
Keep a low profile.
Yeah.
And as well, you're speaking about exploring ideas. Another, again, Star Wars. I think the film was called The Way of the Saber. I cannot recall the exact name, but I remember it was two Asian artists. And what it is, it's a story. It's a short story, kind of done in the Star Wars vein, because they have lightsabers, which are the, you know, for people who don't know, the laser swords of Star Wars. But it's the idea of kind of exploring the idea of war on the battlefield and longing for one's family, and done in a battle. So there's a 5-minute lightsaber fight that's very high level and kind of mixes martial arts in this really interesting way. But it's a kind of a saber movie, but it's a film also about longing for one's family, because it's framed by a letter that this one of these soldiers has written to his wife and his child. And so I connected very much to this idea that what these filmmakers often do is find aspects or angles of the phenomenon, or of the film, I should say, that they aspire to, or that they aspire to remake, that they don't feel has been tapped or touched. Things that Lucas or Cameron or whoever left on the cutting room floor, or just left on the table. Stuff that, you know, like, it's like, what would it be like to explore this aspect of a film that wasn't even discussed in the film?
Oh, and certainly, you know, when you're making a film for yourself and you aren't answering to stockholders and the owners of Warner Brothers or whoever, you can make those decisions. I mean, you can explore it any way you want. I mean, and whereas George Lucas, for better or worse, if he has 2 hours, he has to make a movie which is going to make back the cost of his budget, I suppose. I mean, there's a lot of aspects. But I mean, there's also just... I mean, for instance, like you were talking about Star Wars, there was one made in New Jersey called Reign of the Fallen, which is one of my all-time favorite fan films. It's about an hour long, and it's this very quiet film. It's like something you would see on the Independent Film Channel as opposed to Star Wars. I mean, there's a little bit of special effects, but mostly it's just about relationships and people talking and trying to figure things out. And
In the Star Wars universe.
In the Star Wars universe.
So there's no need. So you're saying it's done this way quietly. It's in the Star Wars universe, but it's not like every 5 minutes there's a lightsaber battle.
Absolutely. I mean, the action is totally besides the point. It's really about the relationships, which is a fascinating way to approach this. You know?
Yeah.
And it's something that, quite honestly, the real studios couldn't do.
They could not do. Lucas doesn't. I mean, well, I guess he could in the sense that he owns the properties and he could if he wants to.
But to make something commercially viable to the level that he needs it in order to make back his money, no, he can't.
You're speaking with Clive Young. He's the author of the new book, Homemade Hollywood, Fans Behind the Camera. It's about the fan film phenomenon in America. Is this an American scene or is it worldwide?
It's grown worldwide. I mean, I have a blog which I run every day about fan films called
ClyveYoung.com.
I have ClyveYoung.com too, mm-hmm. but the blog is fancinematoday.com. And just this week I did a thing about a Star Wars fan film that was made in the United Arab Emirates.
Wow.
Yeah, there's a Chilean Star Wars movie which I'm writing.
United Arab Emirates?
The UAE, yeah.
Lots of Tatooine kind of like.
Absolutely. It was a guy from Brooklyn who moved to over there, and he said, you know what, this is perfect. I'm here.
It's sandy. I can like just do it. Right.
But there's Australia, New Zealand. The Iron Man movie I was thinking of when I mentioned that before was from New Caledonia, which is this tiny island I'd never even heard of before, between New Zealand and Australia, which goes to show my geography skills. But anyway, I'm too busy watching movies on YouTube.
Wow. Anyway. But you say, and you point out very well, that the history of fan films, we know that with this burst in really the very late 90s of people making films with digital cameras, that there was a lot of this, and of course the growth of the internet. But you point out that the earliest roots of this are in the 1920s or 30s?
Sure. The earliest one I was able to find was a Little Rascals movie from the 1920s that was made in the Deep South. But throughout the ages, people have made Andy Warhol made fan films. Hugh Hefner made one in his basement when he was 16, and it was very G-rated. A lot of folks have made these. I mean, there's a fellow in Connecticut, Robbins Barstow, who made a Tarzan movie when he was 16, and I was able to interview him for the book. He's almost 90 now, and man, he was so much fun to talk to. The guy's a spitfire.
I can only imagine. Yeah,
they've been around, and it's with the internet really gave people an opportunity to put them out there so folks could see them, and that created this realization that, gee, everybody's been doing this all along, just nobody knew about anybody else.
Nobody knew about it.
Hmm. Yeah.
Hmm, hmm. You know, you mentioned the legal issues. And you also mentioned this kind of indie film school quality, that people make these films as almost like audition tapes, or it's a way to learn about the camera or the technology. Probably the first fan film that I heard really blowing up was Kevin Rubio's Troops,
which was
a remake, if you will, of the show Cops, but kind of told as though the cops were the stormtroopers of Star Wars, a kind of a stormtroopers version of Cops. And this kind of rode in on the growing internet, and also it was just a huge, massive hit. I know Kevin wanted a film career and was aiming for one, but I don't know what he's done. I might have just not paid attention.
Yeah, he went,
what I'm wondering is what degree do these people ever become like big stars or big celebrities?
There's only
whatever.
Been a few cases. I mean, Kevin wound up, there's a show on Cartoon Network right now called The Clone Wars, which is done by Lucasfilm, and he's written a couple of episodes of that. He does a lot of writing at this point. Probably the highest profile person is a fellow by the name of Eli Roth, who made the Hostel movies a couple of years ago.
That's right.
He started out making Texas Chainsaw Massacre and Pieces remakes in his basement. So he has a history of them. There's a fellow by the name of Joe Nussbaum.
He's a huge success.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, that's a couple of – I mean, I was very lucky to get him to get to interview him for the book. Because, quite frankly, I thought he'd be like, yeah, that? No. But
he was probably very proud of the early work he did.
He was a bit, but he was actually involved in the story of the Raiders of the Lost Ark guys, believe it or not. He was the person who got the tape of it into Steven Spielberg's hands.
Oh,
yeah.
Wow.
So, and so he's been left out of various, like Vanity Fair did a huge story a couple of years ago on the Raiders guys, and he was basically left out of it. So this was his big opportunity to finally get his claim to
get his word in.
But
fascinating. Clive, you know, just before we wrap up, Your first book, this is your second.
Yeah.
And the first book you did was on rock concert roadies. It was called Crank It Up.
Yeah.
And this was your first book. What is behind your interest in niche pop culture? That is to say, to write a book about rock concert roadies and then to follow up with a book about amateur fan filmmakers, you seem to have a kind of predilection that I share to a degree in this interest of these little corners of Americana or pop culture. And what's behind that with you?
Well, you know, the roadie one, I have to admit, sort of came out of my job. I work for a magazine called Pro Sound News where and basically my job is to go to concerts and interview the sound engineers and find out how they make all your favorite acts sound good, even when they're having a bad night and their girlfriend broke up with them just before the show started and this and that. And it kind of came out of that because I was talking to these guys and they would, you know, if I write an article, it's 700 words, and meanwhile they'll tell me how they – I mean, there are thousands of sound engineers, for instance, in the country, but how do you get from playing the local bar to mixing, you know
– Sting
or anybody.
Right.
And, it, you know, they kind of told how they made it up to that level.
Fascinating.
So it was just a fortunate thing that I kind of had all this leftover material, and I said, hey, you know, there's a book here.
There's a book here.
Yeah.
And there's a book here. It's called Homemade Hollywood – Fans Behind the Camera. It's by Clive Young, who's been our guest today here on Nonfiction and at WBAI. And this is just a tremendously fascinating story about this kind of impetus that people have to be creative, but to also express admiration. And if you have not seen a fan film or have not or not read the book, you should certainly go to Media Assassin, my blog, at harryallen.info. There you'll find, under today's posting, a link to Clive Young's website, a link to Jedi.net, I think it's called, which is the source of a lot of Star Wars fan films, and other links that'll connect you. You also see a picture of Clive Young's book cover, so you'll get the sense of seeing what it looks like. So when you head to the store and get your own copy, you'll know what to look for. Again, it's Homemade Hollywood, The Fans Behind the Camera. Clive Young has been our guest. And Clive Young, thanks for being our guest today on Nonfiction and WBAI.
Thank you so much.
Up next, we're going to be speaking with Wendy Slick, who is going to be talking to us about the history of the vibrator. As you might imagine, it's a complicated history, and it's one that she knows a lot about because she's done a film, and the film is called Passion and Power, The Technology of the Orgasm. And again, we're looking forward to that conversation with her in just a few minutes. This is Nonfiction, the magazine of the arts, ideas, and fact. And we'll be back right after this.
Greetings, this is Savion Glover, and you're listening to WBAI, listener-supported, non-commercial radio in New York. Enjoy.
a blank, a back, a back up in the minor, 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 sun, a moon, a moon, and brother, come a come a when I got to bring a bring the tune, the tune, the tune, tune, the tune, to break it down, down. Born, born on the 8th day of December. Remember the time when we broke it down, when we broke it into rhymes. We can be, faster, 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 faster. When we got to come, and then we show it after. It doesn't even matter when we got to hit the flow, and flow, and flow. And if you got to know it, then you come and show it, show it. Groove it, and when we got to groove it, if it's coming in the winter time, and maybe in the summer, if it be no bummer. So, how can it be in a house, in a house, in a house, in a house, 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 house? My time has come to be so different when I come lift it up, when I got to rip it up, shows I might mix it up style. Here it comes when we break it down, get it versatile. Live, hinder me not, cinder me not. When I come from side. And if we gotta come in, then we bring it down. The slower, the power, the more, the move, the shaker. Fixer, sun, moon, crashing into an abyss. Abyss of sounds, so when I don't miss. Here it is, there it went. Wind blows out the window. No smoke and no endo. Smooth and I sense though. How does the wind blow? Through my hair very easily. Cause I have none, have some. My son still be in the house of Sagittarius. Come with various styles I bust if I got to. Come, what's my longitude and ladder? To my attitude is better, better no matter the weather. When I come, I step up. Swiftly I see the rhythms when they hit this type of tune. We cannot stop, no stopping these type of symptoms. When we come, get some drum, drum, feel it, the pump. Mystic rhythm, so psychotic, black male variety. That's me, Kokaibi. My name manifests the same within the same sentence structure. My conjunction motion. When I gotta say just like this, praise the Lord for my life. Far I go, far when I commit. Now far no scars are hit upon the head when I drop. Stick the kick, kicks be dead. Tower mad, the fact if you come like the elemental five. When I gotta mix to the metric.
That was Steve Coleman again and the Mystic Rhythm Society. The 1995 album is titled Myths, Modes, and Means, and that track was called The Initiate. Again, Steve Coleman and the Mystic Rhythm Society from their 1995 album Myths, Modes, and Means, The Initiate. And this is Nonfiction, the magazine of the arts, ideas, and fact. And, wow, what a great conversation with Clive Young. And another one right on the way, Passion and Power, the Technology of Orgasm, is the name of the work. It's a DVD, and it's produced by Wendy Slick with her partner. I just had her name here, and I'm going to say it in a second. Yes, Emiko Omori. It's a documentary, Passion and Power, the Technology of Orgasm, and it's about the history of the vibrator. And Wendy is our guest. We're speaking with her from her her office in California, in the Bay Area. And Wendy, thanks for being our guest today on Nonfiction and at WBAI.
Thank you. I love this radio station.
And you used to live out here in New York.
Yes.
Wow. So
born there.
That's wonderful. It's great to speak to you.
Thank you.
What's this film about?
Well... the film is basically based on a book by Dr. Rachel Maines called The Technology of Orgasm, and it is about the history of the vibrator, but that's just kind of the construct, because the issues are really women's rights issues, and that's kind of how we present this documentary. It's through the history of the vibrator, but a lot of other things come out as we explore this story.
Why did you make it?
You know, my filmmaking partner, Emiko Amori, you did get her name almost right.
Almost right. Emiko, as opposed to Emiko.
That was good,
right.
Yeah.
Thank you.
It was close, mm-hmm. Of course. She and I were at Sundance with another film, and this was about 10 years ago, and a friend of ours introduced us to this book that had just come out called The Technology of Orgasm, and it was The History of the Vibrators by Rachel Maines. And we read it, and, you know, we were 60s kids, and we thought we knew everything. We're feminists. And we read this book, and there's, like, all the stuff in there that we had not known. And how there's a whole history of our rights and who we are as women that is tied to sexuality. And we just, it just hadn't, and it was also very funny, I have to say. The main story, which I'm sure we'll get to in a minute, is very humorous. And as we've been documentary filmmakers very many years and thought it would make a great film. And we did make it. It turned out to be a very hard film to make.
Why do you say that?
You know, this country is, while it's very open, I think, in a lot of ways in terms of our sexuality and who we are, there's really this kind of stigma. It's like, I don't think they were ready for a film, or people who were funding films weren't ready to fund a film that was kind of bridging this gap between, it's not really an academic film, and it's not very lurid. So it's kind of in this middle ground of kind of talking about sex kind of openly, and it's funny and humorously, and yet there's some seriousness to it. So it's kind of a hybrid, and I think it was hard for people to see what that was going to be and enter into that discussion.
That's a really interesting point that you're making. It almost sounds like what you're saying is that it was more light, humorous, and self-reflective than an academic film would be. But it wasn't something that you would only see on HBO's Real Sex or more, let's say, on a porn film.
Right.
So
right.
It was this.
Oh, it's very mainstream.
It's very mainstream. Yes, it is.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And
yeah.
But because of that, people have a problem either with it being made or with it existing or it being seen or screened.
Well, I think so. I mean, the irony is when we finally did get it made, and both Emiko and I basically funded it ourselves, we had one grant. It was from New York, thank you, New York, from the Robeson Foundation. Early on, they gave us a small grant to develop it, because I think they could see they're a very socially conscious foundation, could see the potential interest in the subject. And
is Susan Robeson affiliated with the Robeson Foundation?
You know what? I don't know.
Yes. I know she's a descendant of his. I'm not sure to what degree.
She might be, yeah.
Yeah. And she is a filmmaker.
Yeah.
Yes.
It's a wonderful foundation. Yeah.
Yes. Certainly to get a film like this made. And the film, of course, for those of you who are joining us, is Passion and Power, The Technology of Orgasm. Those are certainly two words you don't tend to see together. It makes such a great title, Technology and Orgasm.
Right.
But that's what this film is about, and it's this story of women's health and women's sexuality is told through this device. It's told through the history of this device. So let's start there. What is a vibrator?
Well, a vibrator is not a dildo. When we were making this movie, everyone would say, oh, you're working on the dildo movie, but we're not. A vibrator is, I guess, you know, Betty Dodson, who's in our movie, would be an expert. Have an expert answer for this. A vibrator is a device that vibrates, and when applied to certain body parts or your back or anywhere, it will stimulate that part of your body.
Now, you just did something very interesting, and you know what it is.
And I know what it is.
And what it is this. As a young person growing up, I saw any number of ads for vibrators, which typically were phallic-shaped and showed
right.
a woman holding it against her cheek. The cheek of her face with a smile on her face. And I'm like,
right.
What? So is this, and I actually used to see, I don't remember the catalog, but some, you know, you used to get those catalogs in the mail that would have tchotchkes of various kinds. And
right.
every now and then you'd see a vibrator in one. And they'd show a woman, you know, with it on her wrist or her hands. And I got the idea that these things were actually that you applied them to your back or to your neck and that you relaxed that way. It wasn't until much later I learned that these were sexual aids. And in fact, a part of your film is dedicated to this earlier kind of, if you will, confusion about the use, because you talk about these earlier, if you will, pre-20th century or post-turn of the century advertisements for vibrators that you saw in Sears catalogs and other places. In fact, Rachel Maines talks about the fact that seeing an ad of this kind is what started her on her path into doing this investigation.
It did. She was doing investigation. She was doing research for a filmmaking friend of mine, actually, on needlework. And this was like 20-something years ago. And when she was going through those old catalogs where they had ads for needlework or needlework catalogs, she found ads for vibrators. And she did the same thing you just said, you know, like, wait a minute. What is this about? And, I mean, what I just did in my little spiel and what you're talking about.
Using it for your back, yes.
Yeah, is social camouflage. It's like saying this is a socially acceptable item because it's being used for something socially acceptable. And masturbation, which is what it's been used for, quite frankly, is not socially acceptable, or it's certainly not going to be in mainstream catalogs.
Well, it's not something the president's going to talk about how often he does, you know?
Right,
People will use it as a punchline or make a joke about it, you know? Mm-hmm. You have the famous Master of Your Domain episode of Seinfeld, for example.
Uh-huh.
But it's not something that people, that you know, that you're going to see being advocated. We remember when Jocelyn Elders advocated masturbation.
Right, and that got her in a lot of trouble.
It was nuts, no pun intended. But the fact of the matter is that no androcentric, pun intended, but the fact of the matter is that this is still an outlaw. Actually, it's strange to use the word outlaw connected to masturbation, given that it's a very common practice for many millions of people, probably.
Yeah, I mean, part of the movie that we made is that we bring up the fact that to sell vibrators, it's illegal in 4 states to sell vibrators. Now, actually, since we made the film, and I hope we were somehow contributory to this, but one state, Texas, has repealed that law. We did follow a woman who was arrested in Texas just a few years ago for selling vibrators.
That's right. And this has happened because in your film you go through the case and you talk about the case of this woman who goes through this legal trouble. And at the end of the film, this law had not been repealed. But you're saying since your film was made, and I think your film was finished in 2007, was it?
Yeah.
Since then, it's been repealed, this law.
Right. It was repealed last Valentine's Day.
Yeah.
It was really fun.
It's poetic.
Yeah,
Texas has a sense
of
poetry. I love it.
I mean, it was maybe a few days before Valentine's Day. But
yeah, just in time for, right?
Yes, exactly.
There you go. But the thing that really interested me in this film is this history of the vibrator as a device.
Mm-hmm.
And also the fact that it originates not as a tool, if you will, marketed as one for sexual pleasure, but as a medical implement. And I think that's what Rachel Maines, the author of the book, The Technology of Orgasm, the title from which you take your subtitle, I think that's what she connected to maybe as well. And can you talk about that a bit? And this history of what's called hysteria,
right,
and what that is. So let's first of all talk about what hysteria is or how it was diagnosed or what the diagnosis of hysteria was. It was a disease, at least in the eyes of physicians, that many women suffered from, and it was marked by what symptoms?
Well, I mean, hysteria, the actual disease, goes back like 2,500 years.
Yes.
I mean, so we start to see a history of the medicalization of what we now look at as just traits of women, you know. So hysteria was any kind of moodiness, not listening properly. I mean, they went so far as to, what we have in the film is list of symptoms of like reading French novels with tight corsets. There was, you know, too much lubrication, not enough lubrication, wanting sex, not wanting sex. All these were signs of hysteria.
Now, in The Technology of Orgasm, Rachel Maines' book, again, and Rachel Maines is in your film, and you draw from this, her research. Hysteria is characterized by, and I'm quoting, anxiety, sleeplessness, irritability, nervousness, erotic fantasy, sensations of heaviness in the abdomen, lower pelvic edema, or edema,
edema,
and vaginal lubrication. And I'm going to continue to read from my post on Media Assassin, my blog today. Hysteria was treated by inducing paroxysm in the patient, massaging her genitals until this state was reached, paroxysm. Manual methods like the water massage technique, which we illustrate on the website, were applied. The development of early steam or manually powered vibrators, though, enabled doctors to stop using their hands and fingers for this task of inducing paroxysm, while electric vibrators, and there's a picture of one on Media Assassin at harryallen.info, made the process even more efficient. And then we continue and say this. If you've just read the previous paragraph in semi-disbelief, then said to yourself, hold up, in the 1800s, people were going to the doctor so he could get you off, you're halfway there. And I think that, and just closing out from there, I think that what really confused me about this history is that that's pretty much what it sounds like. If I can summarize, that throughout the ages, women have suffered from, for lack of a better word, restlessness because they were, for all intents and purposes, horny. And so, but that women's horniness or women's desire was not recognized. It was not recognized as legitimate, even. It was not recognized that women had sexual desires. And so, to cure women of this, they induce paroxysm through this manual stimulation of the genitals, which is basically bringing her to orgasm.
Right, and releasing all this anxiety.
But this whole thing was framed a whole other way. In other words,
think of the word control.
Yes, the word control. In other words, to put it another way, the only way I can, and we mentioned this in the piece, the only way I can relieve a woman's sexual desire but not acknowledge she has any is I have to put it in a category of disease. I have to say there's something wrong with her. And she goes to the doctor. I mean, because when you hear about it today, it's like, wait a minute, you were sending your wife to the doctor so he could make her, you know, come?
Now, this happened in the 1850s.
Yes.
In that era. I mean, that didn't happen all the way through time. But
yes.
There have been history, which Rachel points out, and we point out a bit in the film, is of you know, the thing about women's orgasm or women's sexual pleasure throughout history is that at the time, there was a time when it was thought that women had to have orgasms in order to conceive.
Yes.
Well, you can imagine how honored they were then.
Yes.
Well, when it was discovered that they didn't need to have orgasms to conceive, then the androcentric, which is a word you just used, which we should define,
yes,
that view came into being and it didn't matter. Androcentric being looking through the world through a male-centered filter.
Yes.
You know. So it is interesting history because here you have this term hysteria, and then to cure it, husbands in the in the Victorian times would send their wives to doctors to get cured. And basically the wives weren't getting off with the husbands, so that's why they needed to be cured.
Whoa! It's bizarre!
So it gets even deeper. Excuse me. That's the other thing about making this film. There are all these double entendres.
Well, whenever you talk about sex, it's like the double entendres come from every direction.
Everywhere,
and you're not even expecting them. Yeah.
You know. You know, at film festivals, we'd get up on the stage and say, oh, thank you for coming, and go, oh, God, I didn't just say that.
Rimshot.
You know.
And there's another one right there, rimshot. Anyway, go on.
So where were we?
Yes.
Women were so these doctors are basically massaging these women to orgasm manually, and it takes them a long time, and they don't like doing it. So the invention of the vibrator comes in the like mid-1800s, and these doctors realize they can use this vibrator, and it cuts down the time from like an hour to 10 minutes. So all of a sudden, but they can't just use a small device. Doctors have to make these devices into something that women couldn't get without them, but it has to seem medical, right? So the first vibrators are giant. They're like the size of a kitchen table. Are you still there?
I'm there. I'm listening. I'm entranced.
Like a kitchen table, and they've got all these knobs and bells and whistles and these wonderful names like the Chattanooga and the, you know. So there are these giant vibrators, and women go to the doctors to use them. Then what starts to happen is when electricity happens and it's more in the homes and the Industrial Revolution starts to happen and ruralization starts to happen in the country, they become smaller and they're more like home devices, even though they're
still plugging into
elaborate.
A wall.
they still plug into a wall.
Yes, but they become smaller. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
They're smaller than the big, you know, going to a doctor and spending how much you would have to spend.
Right.
So women, that's when they started to get into catalogs. Women started to order these and use them by themselves.
Mm-hmm.
So, and that was in Sears catalog. General Electric made them. Hamilton Beach made them. And these were mainstream things.
And in your film, we see ads. We see the ads mm-hmm. with, you know, Sears right there on it, you know, or whatever, for these devices. And just one more thing, of course, which should be obvious, and that is if you're a doctor and you're treating a woman, you can go from an hour, you know, treating her manually to 10 minutes. That means a lot more patients are coming through your door, which means more money for you as well.
Exactly.
So there's also this other aspect of it that's amazing, that having to do with the development of this device.
Well, and I, you know, to jump ahead to now, I still think there's a lot of medicalization of women by the pharmaceutical industry.
Explain what you mean, please.
In economics. I mean, all these diseases we're supposed to have, what, PMS and this syndrome and that syndrome. I'm not saying we don't have our things and moods, but I don't know. It was we had a list, I don't have it in front of me, when we were researching this, of about 20 different diseases that have these names to them that they were, you know, that the medical world is trying to convince us that we may have.
You know, Wendy, I think you are really onto something, and not just onto something, but that this film, and the film is called Passion and Power: The Technology of Orgasm. That this film gets to, and that is that the way that women's health is often dealt with or treated is often through contempt of a certain kind. And that is to say that...
That's interesting. Yeah.
That PMS, you know, like people make mm-hmm. jokes about, like, about the condition that some women suffer because of what's going on in their bodies. They make jokes about it, you know, or they talk about women's health or the normalness that the things that women go through normally is something to be feared, something to be cured, something to be avoided.
Right.
There's things that just have to do with equilibrium in the body.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think your film speaks about this in this very, very pointed way, about this particular development in our history. But you just made a really good point, certainly one that we hear here at WBAI, and we talk about a great deal here at the station, as you know, that this is not a single situation. It's not something that happened back then. That this is continuous and ongoing, this kind of fragmentation of the female body into these parts that can be kind of moved around.
We also have a wonderful local person. Oh, actually, a lot of our characters in the film are from New York. But Reno, who's one of your stand-up comics.
Yes, she's something else.
Yeah.
Funny.
She's in the film as well, because I think we have to be able to look at this from all aspects. And one of them is, you know, politically, how kind of absurd and bizarre this is, that we have this history and that we're kind of still in it now.
Yes, and we're still in it because this is a continuum of the culture, that this way of looking at sexuality and at women, this is an ongoing thing. It's something that's changing in many ways, but it's something that's still there.
Yeah.
It's something that's still there. How can people see this film? It's not something that's screening in theaters or on television.
Well, we were in theaters for a limited run, but unfortunately we didn't get a New York theater. But you can order it off our website. That'll push you to our distributor. Our website is www.passionandpowerthemovie.com or Technology of Orgasm.
The Technology of Orgasm. Is that correct?
Either one. TheTechnologyOfOrgasm.com or TechnologyOfOrgasm.com.
Wonderful. Well, our guest today has been Wendy Slick, and the film is Passion and Power, The Technology of Orgasm, the story of the vibrator as a device in American culture, but it's about so much more. And if you're interested in women's health, women's sexuality, history of technology, or all these issues, or just seeing a good, funny film about American history, and that's what it is as well, you should certainly get your hands on a copy of Passion and Power, Technology of Orgasm. Wendy Slick, thanks for being our guest today on Nonfiction and at WBAI.
Thank you so much. You're a wonderful interviewer.
And that'll bring this week's edition of Nonfiction to a close. We want to thank our guests, Clive Young and Wendy Slick, for their ideas and insights. Nonfiction is a co-production of both the Arts Department at WBAI and of Media Assassin. Read the Media Assassin blog for news and information about upcoming shows at harryallen.info. Our engineer is Michael G. Haskins. Additional production was provided by Jeff Snyder, Grand Mixer DXT, and Harry Allen. Special thanks to Zakiya D. McGregor, Kiko Nosferatu, the staff and volunteers at WBAI, but most of all, to you, our listeners, members, and supporters, without whom none of this would be possible. 99.5 FM would be stuck somewhere out in a doctor's office, suffering from a case of hysteria, all without a vibrator, no doubt sent there by the evil Clear Channel Corporation. Please continue to support WBAI with your donations and gifts. Email us at nonfictionradio@yahoo.com. That's nonfictionradio@yahoo.com. Up next, Earl Caldwell and the Caldwell Chronicle. For Nonfiction, I'm your host, Harry Allen, wishing you an excellent and blessed week.
Experience was unelectrified. We had tremendous good plumbing in my house. My father was an electrician, and he was very, very good with plumbing as well. And we had this torrential bath, like you could have put out a two-story house fire with the bathtub flow. It was before I went to school. I think I was probably like 4 or 5. I used to sit in the bathtub. I was, relatively good at it without mécanique. And I was doing it since I'm like, as I say, 4 or 5 on a regular basis.
That was just a little bit of the audio from the film Passion and Power, The Technology of Orgasm, by filmmakers Wendy Slick and Emiko Omori. Wendy Slick, guest on Nonfiction with Harry Allen. Thank you so much for tuning in. Again, this is 99.5 FM, WBAI, and WBAI.org. Coming up in a few minutes, The Caldwell Chronicle with Earl Caldwell. And once again, you are tuned to 99.5 FM WBAI and WBAI.org on the web. Coming up at 5 p.m. will be the Jordan Journal with Howard Jordan. That's the Jordan Journal with Howard Jordan, the WBAI evening news at 6 o'clock. And again, thank you so much for tuning in. Please visit our website, WBAI.org, just as often as you can to help keep commercial-free, listener-supported radio on the air. You can visit that website, and right in the middle of the homepage, on the right-hand side, of the homepage, you'll see a space that says Donate Now, and that's where you go to contribute to WBAI.